WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're going to talk movies this hour. Later, Godzilla. But first, superheroes. If you head to a theater next month, it's quite possible you'll see at least 5 superhero movies for your choosing. Joining us to talk about the enduring popularity of superhero movies is Robert Thompson. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University, where he is also a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. And I wonder, just to start out, have the reasons why we like superheroes, do you think those have changed, or is it still kind of all of us just dreaming about being a little more than mortal?
Well, I think that's at the very bottom of it. I mean, we can talk later about how superheroes are becoming perhaps more relevant to what's going on in the world, although comic book superheroes were doing that back during the Second World War. But I think there is, at the very bottom of this idea of it is a great fantasy that you're living in the world where your boss is beating you down and people are bullying you and all the stuff that happens to people in the regular world, and the fantasy that you've got this secret, that you're incredibly powerful, is a really, really great fantasy. And let's face it, we have been creating as a culture superheroes for a long, long time. The Iliad and the Odyssey are filled with them, and that's those are thousands of years old. Some of the earliest stories we ever told were about people with superpowers.
So then, is it us admiring that person on the screen, or is it us thinking what it would be like to be that person on the screen?
Well, I think it's a complex calculus of all kinds of different things. I mean, when I was a kid, for me, growing up in the 60s and 70s, it was the $6 million man. I mean, I just thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could run that fast and were that strong and all of that kind of thing? And that was simple. There was very little equation to that. That was kind of a simple-minded story, and I was watching it in a simple-minded and childish way. Now we've got these superheroes who both we kind of admire and wish we could be like, but at the same time, many of these superheroes have dark sides. Many of the very powerful are very bad. I mean, it's a lot more complicated than it was growing up with the superheroes of, let's say, the 1960s.
And it seems like those superhero movies, they sort of come in waves. There was a bit of a wave in the 80s with the Superman movies, another wave in the 90s, a few Batman movies in there. Why do we see those waves?
Right. Well, I think popular culture tends to go in these kinds of biorhythms, namely because they're operating under the first law of entertainment dynamics, which is when something works really well, everybody tries to imitate it, and then that imitation leads to a certain saturation, and they tend to back off for a while until there's some cultural palate cleansing, and then it all comes back in another wave. I think now, though, the superhero genre has reached it's not just a little, you know, subgenre that comes and goes. I think now it has become such a massive part of what Hollywood does that I think we're going to wait a long time before we see this wave recede. We've already got, as we're watching these movies this summer, the sequels have either already been started or are completely planned. I mean, these have their own second, third, and fourth generations already built into them.
And who's going to see the movies? I guess on the surface, I would guess teenage boys are there, but there must be more than that going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly we think of the stereotype of the comic book superhero reader. We always think of an angst-ridden teenage boy or even younger. And these movies still skew toward young male audiences. But in the past, even over a decade now, since the Batman movies and it might even go back to the Christopher Reeve Superman Superman movies. These comic book superheroes have way transcended what we think of as the comic book audience. There are millions and millions of people going to watch these movies who have never read the comic books upon which they are based. And that was the important thing to happen. These superheroes had to break free of the gravitational pull of the comic book reader, of the comic book fan. And once they were able to be, once they were something that everybody was watching in spite of that comic book world, that's how they're making, $700 million-plus at the box office.
They have to be careful not to alienate those hardcore fans, though, don't they? Because these are people who understand these worlds in intricate ways, and if you violate the rules, that's a problem.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you are so right about that, in that you have got a fan base, and it's a pretty substantial fan base, who takes these universes very, very seriously. And you can't mess with them, and you especially can't be careless. If you're going to change something or shift it, you've got to do it acknowledging that that you're doing it. And now Marvel has this Marvel Cinematic Universe, as they call it, which is now, each movie is intricately linked, and it affects what happens on Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in the second season as an ABC television series this coming fall is going to have been impacted by what's happening in these movies that are coming out this summer. So it's almost like they must have these extraordinary charts that keep all of this stuff straight. And when you're directing one Marvel universe of superheroes, you've got to be cognizant of what you need to do to make it fit in with what's going to happen in the next one. It's really one of the most sort of complicatedly large super narratives that I can think of in storytelling history. I mean, we had Greek mythology, and Aeschylus and Euripides would deal with it one way, and Homer would deal with it another way, and Hesiod would deal with it another. But here we've now got, in many cases, coordinated, complicated superstructures of narrative in these comic books that English professors would do well to be paying serious attention to.
We're talking with Robert Thompson from Syracuse University. If you want to join the conversation, have you seen some of these movies? Any thoughts to help contribute to the conversation here? The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. The email is radiotimes@whyy.org. And on Twitter, our handle is WHYY Radio Times. So this process of sort of broadening the base of superhero movie fans, one of the things that I think I've noticed that I suspect could accomplish this is it seems like superheroes are becoming a lot more attractive. I mean, like model hot. I mean, when you think of Batman and Michael Keaton early on, Michael Keaton, a fine-looking man, but Christian Bale, I mean, there's sexuality in there, and more attractiveness. Christopher Reeve as Superman, Henry Cavill as Superman is a different Superman altogether. Is there something in that?
Well, there certainly is. I mean, you can trace these the physiological or the physical types of these stars from the early movies to now, and there's definitely something. It's trending hot, let's put it that way. however, I'm not sure how much of that is just that we're really seeing these superheroes are now reflecting new ideas or slightly new ideas of what constitutes physical perfection, which Hollywood has always liked to trade in. I mean, and it's not just superheroes. You go to see the Son of God, and Jesus Christ himself is disturbingly good-looking to many people. So I think part of it is, I remember when those first Superman movies came out, which back then were, I think, really a fine set of films. And Christopher Reeves was really considered an extraordinary, beautiful beautiful man. Now, George Reeves, that was a whole different story. But Christopher Reeve for the 70s was a pretty young man. And I think maybe it's not so much that superheroes are changing, is that our idea of what makes constitutes physical perfection has altered a bit. Maybe part of it has to do with you know, better gym equipment.
Yeah, they are a lot muscular, it seems like.
Oh, and I'll say. They don't need the little prosthetic outfits anymore. It seems to me they're carrying the guns themselves of both kinds.
You've already touched on this next point I want to talk about. There are a lot more people going to these movies, but it seems to be it's not just about demand, but also about the supply, because the studios love these movies. They make a lot of money.
Well, I think the reason for it is, in many ways, the comic book superhero and the Hollywood movie of the 21st century are an absolute match made in heaven. First of all, movies and comic books are a perfect match, and they go back to the beginning. Windsor McKay, who was used to draw the comic strip Little Nemo and Dreams of a Rarebit Fiend, he animated a dinosaur in one of the first moving pictures way back in the dawn of the movies, and vice versa. Charlie Chaplin would be turned into comic books while he was still a big star. The fact that a movie is about visual frames. Before you make a movie, you make a storyboard. A storyboard is essentially a comic book. So in so many ways, comic books are perfectly adaptable to the medium of movies. You just have to take the frames and move them really fast so they start to move. Secondly, now that we are in this era of this incredible technology, computer graphics and wonderful 3D. Notice how most of these movies, almost all of them, are coming out in 3D, and most of them are coming out in IMAX 3D, should you choose to do that. Hollywood, of course, loves to have subjects that will show off all that new technology. They also love to have subjects that can justify 3D, so they can charge way extra for the tickets. These 3D movies make a wheelbarrow full of extra money. So that's the match made in heaven. And then finally, they are so franchisable. I mean, the sequels are built in. The spreadability of these universes is automatic. It doesn't take any kind of stretch of the imagination how to make sequels of these things ad infinitum. And then you've got all these minor characters, which they're now seeding as Netflix series. And if they can introduce people and train them to like these characters as Netflix series, then they get to graduate into actual films. It's almost like the comic book superheroes, especially the Marvel Universe, allows Hollywood a way to completely gear up production like you used to make automobiles in a Detroit assembly line. It's completely mass-producible.
Sort of like printing money. We're talking about superheroes on Radio Times. Our guest is Robert Thompson with Syracuse University. We have him for just a few more minutes if you want to join the conversation. The telephone number is 888-477-9499. You can email radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break.
The Friends Schools of Bucks County are committed to challenging minds and nurturing spirits to prepare students for life. Providing independent education from preschool through 12th grade, the Friends Schools of Bucks County include United Friends, Newtown Friends, Buckingham Friends, and the George School. Guided by Quaker values, these schools provide a core curriculum while fostering exploration, self-discipline, creativity, and a desire to learn. United Friends, Newtown Friends, Buckingham Friends, and the George School support WHYY.
Next time in Studio 360, novelist Tom Perata, the author of Little Children, on a classic novel of adultery.
The real crime isn't desire, it's hypocrisy. And I think that's a specific American view of sex.
Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter from our series American Icons, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. As NBC's The Voice draws to a season close, we'll catch up with last year's runner-up, Michelle Chamuel.
People are like, wow, what does it feel like? Is it like, you know, a dream? And it's like, it's amazing, but at the same time, it's people have different opportunities, and I think it's just
You're always you. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're talking about the enduring appeal of superheroes with Robert Thompson. He's with Syracuse University. And we have a few people checking in with us here. We heard from Vicky, and she commented on also our next topic, which is going to be Godzilla. But she says, Vicky says on Facebook that she loves superhero movies, and not just because she has three young boys, but that she did see Godzilla and she was a little disappointed. If you expect sort of high art in some of these movies, you might be disappointed. Is that right, Robert Thompson?
Well, in the old definition of high art, yes. I mean, these things are. We used to define what wasn't high art by saying comic books. Comic books was a way of saying, oh, that movie was like a comic book. It was the way of defining the opposite of high art. But I've got to say that some of these films that have come out in the past couple of decades are, I think, making even the stodgiest, elitist people rethink that idea that comic books should be a synonym for two-dimensional and fluffy and all of that kind of stuff. Some of these films have not been great films, but I think the Tobey Maguire cycle of Spider-Man's had some really interesting stuff in it, not only cinematically, but novelistically. This latest Captain America film, I mean, it's not Citizen Kane, but nor is it Joe versus the Volcano.
We had another Facebook comment from David. He said, superhero movies are the mythology of my childhood. You've probably heard that before.
Right, and I think that's a perfectly good explanation. I mean, when you look at the way superheroes and the superhero universes are, where each one has a different power and each one is kind of in charge of a different sort of area of human need or endeavor, I mean, these characters do really remind one of the Mount Olympus gods, Zeus and Hera and all the rest, or at least of the heroes that were under their inspiration, the Jason of the Argonauts fame, and Heracles and Perseus and Theseus and all the rest of it. Those, of course, were attached to a theology, which is the big difference, that our superheroes now behave an awful lot like them, get into similar kinds of adventures, but they are fully secular unless you really take these seriously.
We're going to go to the telephone, and we have Sean on the on the line from Audubon. Sean, you're welcome to Radio Times.
Hello. Very interesting topic. The reason I was calling was just to kind of touch base. You were talking about moving in waves, and I don't foresee it going anywhere anytime soon. It's being reported now that Sony's offering Andrew Garfield a multi-million-dollar contract for Spider-Man through 2020.
Oh.
So obviously a long time they're planning now.
Wow, through 2020, Robert Thompson.
Right, yeah, I mean, all one has to do is, right, look at the budgets and who's been hired. I mean, I think, what, NBC now has the Olympics up to 2032, so we know that's not going to go in waves, well, four-year waves maybe. So I think the idea of this being a come-and-go kind of genre is probably over. I think this is the genre that is already looks to be completely dominating the kind of movie Hollywood makes, and maybe the kind of movie it's going to be making for a long, long time.
Let's go back to the telephone. We have Michelle in Bordentown. Michelle, you're on Radio Times.
Hi. I grew up watching the superhero movies of the 70s and 80s, and now I have a seven-year-old who loves the superheroes of today. I'm curious if you have any thoughts or comments about the level of violence and the difference between those previous movies and today's movies.
Yes, the level of violence in the ones your son is watching is like 500 times higher than the ones that you were watching. I go back and watch those old Superman movies, and they're so incredibly quaint. At least for most of the time. Now, by the time you get to the big battle at the end of these movies, you're almost completely exhausted by the rapid fire, the explosions, the fireballs, and all of the rest of it. You know, in the 21st, we started the 21st century with one of the most horrible visualized acts of violence that we could ever conceive, and the movies somehow seem to then have to go up to that bar. And I think that's one of the reasons why the movies have decided to go to these big visual epics. If you want the high art that we were talking about before, watch television. It's going on in True Detective and Mad Men and The Wire and all those shows that have been going for the last 20 years. The high artsy sort of stuff now is going on in TV. The big, massive visual effects things are what movies can still do better than anyone else. And that means that these things tend to be a lot more violent than they were 20 years ago.
We have one final caller here, Charles from Trenton, New Jersey. And Charles, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, just a quick question. Is Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. a totally new thing happening with TV, with the link, the movie, back to TV, back to movie? In my life, I haven't ever seen that combination. I don't know if it's ever happened.
Well, there have been some other cases where we have had certain stories that have crossed media, certainly from radio to TV, but we've had a number of other universes that have gone radio, TV, movies, and even novels and all the rest of it, but not in quite the way that this is happening in the Marvel Universe, where each one is really completely linked. It's not just the characters. It's that something that happens in this movie has then an effect on what's going to happen in the TV series. The X-Files movie, remember when that was made, it was the same characters and everything else, but it was kind of its own independent thing. These things actually have ripple effects throughout all the other movies in the universe, and I think that is something comparatively new.
Robert Thompson is a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Now we're going to switch to Godzilla. I don't think I could say that and give the name justice, but Godzilla. Maybe we need to scream it. But joining me here in the studio is Frank Chance. He's a scholar of early modern Japanese art at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is associate director of the Center for East Asian Studies. And since 2007, you've been teaching a freshman seminar on monsters of Japan. So how did you get started teaching that?
Well, I often tell my students that Godzilla is actually my first cinematic memory. The very first thing I remember when I was about 8 years old was the first broadcast of Godzilla on American television and hearing the thunderous footsteps at the beginning of it and just it scared my pants off. Today, that kind of special effect doesn't work nearly as well as it did back then. But that's where I started getting interested in these films. I saw many of them. I'm not going to say all of them, as I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s. Then, as Dr. Thompson mentioned, these things go in waves. And after 1976, there's a long break, and for about 10 years, there's not another Godzilla movie being made in Japan. Then there's a second wave from 1985 up until about the year 1998, when the first American version of Godzilla is made. That film was such a disaster critically that the Japanese decided they had to make response to it and made half a dozen more films. So that's three waves, and right now we're either at the end or the beginning of another wave. We'll see. It's just the 60th year since the first Godzilla film was made.
And can you tie those waves to any events or anything happening in the world? Or are they just sort of natural business progressions?
Well, they're business related. But they also tie into actual events in the world. Godzilla 1985, the revival at the beginning of that second wave, was very much a movie about the Cold War. and the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviets as it was read in Japan. The 1998 movie was very much a response to new technology and was the first CGI Godzilla. The Japanese didn't like it so much that they went back to using what we call suitmation, a man in a rubber suit performing the monster. Actually, that comes full cycle. I had contact with a friend who was in Japan, in the audience of the theater in Japan when the current movie opened, and he was sitting next to Satsuma Kenpachiro, the man who was in the suit for the first 12 Godzilla movies.
Oh, wow.
So it's really come full cycle in many, many ways.
And there have been, what, about 29 or 30 Godzilla movies?
It depends on how you count movies.
Okay.
There have been 30 theatrical releases, not including Bambi Meets Godzilla.
Bambi Meets Godzilla.
Which was a short that I saw the theatrical release of in 1969, an animated version. Very short movie.
Okay. I can imagine, because it doesn't sound like much of a matchup.
And, of course, there are now dozens of short films on the internet with Godzilla involved. Godzilla fighting against Darth Vader or Bambi. Or lots of other options.
And tell us about that first Godzilla movie. As I understand, that was made in Japan in 1954. That would be the 60 years.
It was made in Japan in 1954. It was very much a response to both the, at that point, 10-year-old history of Japan being bombed by the United States and the nuclear weapons use in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Also, in some ways, a response to the conventional firebombing of Tokyo, which actually killed more people than the nuclear bombs did. In addition, it was said to have been inspired by the director, Honda Ishiro. Honda was flying back from Indonesia to Japan, and it's reported that he looked out the window of his plane and saw a flash, which was one of the atomic tests in the South Pacific.
Mm.
Whether it's true or not, we'll never know, but Honda said it happened. So nuclear testing is also a theme that has run very consistently through the Japanese Godzilla movies from the beginning up to the current one.
Yeah, that's always there. In fact, even the monster's breath is radioactive, right?
That's what they say, and it's sure what it looks like on the film.
And it changes, though. Yeah, it's not. Has the breath always been radioactive? Has that always been one of the consistent characteristics?
The first version, it was described as a heat ray coming out of Godzilla. Later on, it becomes radioactive breath or an atomic ray that Godzilla can project. And it plays a big role in the current movie. So I won't release any spoilers, but it's certainly there.
We're talking about Godzilla, and we have in the studio Frank Chance of the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Jeff Brady. This is Radio Times. Now, there was a U.S. version of Godzilla that came out after that initial one 60 years ago in Japan in 1958, with sort of the nuclear attack being a big part of that Japanese version of Godzilla, that first one. Did they change the story a little bit there?
They edited the film quite a bit. It was over 90 minutes long in Japan and only about 78 minutes long when it was released in the U.S., despite the fact that there was added footage in the U.S. version. They inserted a new character played by Raymond Burr of Ironside and Perry Mason fame, who played a reporter named Steve Martin, who, luckily enough for him, or unluckily enough, had just arrived in Japan as the Godzilla attack began. Interestingly, they decided not to dub the film into English, but to have Steve Martin explain what was happening, often with the help of a Japanese interpreter, who was also inserted into the film. What they cut was a lot of the scenery of the devastation of Tokyo, so that it makes it much more of a film about figuring out this monster, rather than the devastation of Japan. Godzilla is moved from being a very clear symbol for America's attack on Japan to becoming a much more simply malevolent force of nature.
Hey, over the years, has Godzilla sort of been used to illustrate the relationship between the U.S. and Japan then?
One of the sequels that wasn't seen very much in America because of copyright issues was a film called Godzilla vs. King Kong, where Godzilla very much, by that point, had become a symbol for Japan and King Kong a symbol for America. So much so that the two versions released in the U.S. and in Japan have slightly different editing for the ending. In the Japanese version, Godzilla's roar is the final thing that we hear. In the American version, it's King Kong who gets the last word.
Wow, so tailored to the audience then.
Absolutely.
And even with this current film, sort of Japanese-U.S. relations come in a little bit outside of the film itself, because we're not going to talk too much about it, because I think that a lot of people probably haven't seen it, and we don't want to spoil it for everyone. But I saw an article on Time Magazine's website. It said the Japanese are fat-shaming the new Godzilla. Have you heard about this?
I've heard a little bit that there are complaints that the new guy is a little bit on the heavy side. Actually, I think he's a reference to the wave of Godzilla films in the 1990s, where he's much more bulked up than he was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s version. There's clearly references in the new film to things like the tsunami of March 2011.
An incident that also has a nuclear nexus?
That also has a nuclear nexus. There is also a nuclear meltdown in the film. So those references are very, very contemporary. And it's certainly a film for the 20-teens, much more so than any of the earlier times.
And did you actually? When we come back, we're going to hear a little bit of the film. I'm excited to go see it myself. You say you have already seen it, correct?
I saw it on the preview evening last week.
Okay, and your 15-second review.
It's a really good film, a very respectful and respectable renewal of one of the biggest stars in movie history.
We're talking about Godzilla with Frank Chance. He's a scholar of early modern Japanese art at the University of Pennsylvania. He also, since 2007, has been teaching a freshman seminar on the monsters of Japan. If you'd like to join the conversation, have you seen the film? What did you think? Give us a review. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. If you're interested in the history, give us a call and ask us your question. You've got an expert here in the studio. The email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
Edward St. Aubyn just won Britain's only literary award for comic fiction for his new novel, Satirizing Literary Awards. Aubyn is also the author of five semi-autobiographical novels about coming of age in a monstrous aristocratic family. Those books are social satires, but they're filled with pain. Edward St. Aubyn joins us on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon is fighting a lonely battle.
If we do not reform our surveillance laws and practices, we are all going to live
to regret it.
Senator Wyden says the proposed USA Freedom Act is the way to keep America from becoming a surveillance nation. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about Godzilla with Frank Chance of the University of Pennsylvania. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. I want to turn to the current Godzilla and have a little clip here that we're going to play. Bryan Cranston, the actor who was in Breaking Bad, he plays a nuclear physicist in the film, and he figures heavily in the beginning of this trailer. I'm sure that if you've watched any television or you've looked around at all, you've seen this trailer. We have some audio of that we're going to play. You can't see what's going on, but I think you'll get a sense of the drama from this clip.
I want to talk to somebody in charge. You are not fooling anybody when you say that what happened was a natural disaster. You're lying. It was not an earthquake. It wasn't a typhoon. Because what's really happening is that you're hiding something out there. And it is going to send us back to the Stone Age.
All right, I'm scared. There was one scene in that video clip where we actually see the Statue of Liberty, and it looks like her arm has been bitten off. did you get a feel of the movie that you saw from that clip?
Actually, I thought the trailers for this film were very, very well done. They really set you up for what's going to happen in the film without revealing too many of the secrets. One of my complaints about a lot of trailers for films these days is that by the time you've watched the trailers, you've seen the entire movie. That's definitely not the case for this film. There are some secrets that you'll never, ever figure out from the trailers.
Wow, that's good. I saw an interview with the director of the movie. His name is Gareth Edwards. This was at Comic-Con, the convention, last year in 2013. And he had some interesting things to say about sort of the character of Godzilla. And I'm going to read his words directly here from the interview. He says that he always viewed Godzilla as a force of nature. He's not like King Kong, where there's a personality, but that Godzilla is a representation of the wrath of nature, and goes on to even say that the theme of man versus nature and Godzilla is certainly that nature element, and you can't win that fight, the director says. He says nature's always going to win, and that's represented in this film.
Absolutely. It's a long tradition in Godzilla films to have Godzilla fighting against some other monster. Maybe the closest parallel to the current film is actually the 1971 film Godzilla versus the Smog Monster, where Godzilla is trying to bring back the balance of nature against mankind's foolish creation of smog and pollution and water pollution and air pollution and so forth.
Well, then I almost heard an hear an environmental message in director Gareth Edwards' interview. He says, nature's always going to win, and that's what the subtext of our movie is about. Godzilla is an anti-hero. I wouldn't describe him as a good guy, but he's not evil personified. He's the punishment we deserve.
In the 1970s films, sometimes Godzilla is portrayed as a real friend of humans, particularly small children who can call him to help them against the smog monster and so forth. But in the 1990s films, Godzilla becomes a force of nature that may be fighting against another monster, but it's not to save humanity. It's just because of Godzilla's own unfathomable reasons. And he really doesn't care how many people are in the way. He's only concerned about his own enemy of his own magnitude. And that's very much the attitude that Edwards took in this film. And as a result, even though some audiences applaud when Godzilla first appears on the screen, it's not because they expect him to save mankind, but simply because he's fighting against something bigger than all of us.
So maybe it's almost more helpful to think of Godzilla as like a hurricane or something like that.
Well, many, many of the films, Godzilla is linked to storms. He arrives in the first film in storms and waves, very clearly like a typhoon. In many of the later sequels, and in particularly in the 1998 American version, he's in rain and wind and night much of the time, if not all the time. So the linkage between Godzilla and those kinds of storms is very strong.
We have some Godzilla fans on the telephone. We're going to bring into the conversation here Chris in Frankfurt. You're on Radio Times. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. And you're here with our guest?
Yes, yes. I just had a brief comment that you might want to remember the Godzilla movies in the 50s and 60s also spawned a host of imitators. I can remember seeing a couple when I was a kid, Gorgo and Reptilicus and so forth. I don't know what pertinence they might have, but I remember being pretty thrilled with Gorgo. It was the British equivalent to Godzilla. Huh.
And Frank, are you familiar with these that he's mentioning?
One of the things I teach about in my course is Godzilla's spawn, as we call them. The many films that responded to Godzilla and other monster movies of the 1950s. Gorgo is interesting because I think it's the only one of these films, or the first one of these films, where mother love is the motivating force behind the giant monster. It actually goes into London to rescue its child. And it shows you that in almost all these films, the monster plays some kind of metaphorical role. It's not just some evil giant beast, but it's got meaning behind it. And for that film, it's the meaning of parental love. For the current film, it has to do with nature and natural balance. For other films, Godzilla played the role of metaphorical America, or other times he's just the evil of the universe. In some films, he's even portrayed the spirits of all the people who died in World War II, wow, both the Japanese victims and all the other victims. So there are many, many different ways to play out what that monster means to us.
We have another Godzilla fan on the telephone, Michael from Glenside in Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I just want to say I have seen all the Godzilla movies except for the 1985 one, and I have seen the new one. I think is probably one of the best out there so far. They did a very good job with just building tension throughout the movie and bringing a newfound respect for the monster, a respect that I think some people overlook because, you know, there are some definitely cheesy ones out there.
Huh, Michael, you're a good movie reviewer here. What do you think of Michael's review of Godzilla?
It's a good review. I think he's right on point. And Michael, I recommend that you get the 1985 version. It's often marketed here or bears the title of Return of Godzilla.
All right, thank you. I plan on it. It looks really good.
And let's go back to the telephone. We have Ed from Lumberton, New Jersey. Ed, you're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I took my sons this weekend, and my oldest is 12, he's in 7th grade, and his friend are both big Godzilla fans, and I loved the movie. I thought it was great, and it did bring back like a nostalgic feeling of some of the older Godzilla movies. But the one criticism that my children had is that there wasn't enough Godzilla in the movie. The movie spent a lot of time developing the villain, and not enough time actually showing Godzilla. That's what they were really anticipating. I thought that was interesting that they had brought that up.
I've heard that criticism from other people too. What did you think of that, Frank?
I would echo that. I think for dramatic reasons, Godzilla was kept off the screen for a long time. I thought there wasn't enough Godzilla, and I frankly thought there wasn't enough Bryan Cranston either. But nonetheless, those are the kinds of decisions that directors make, and the story played out very nicely in a lot of ways. It's too bad Godzilla didn't get more screen time. I think we can only hope for a sequel where we get to see more of him.
And so in this movie, and we've touched on this, but what do you think Godzilla represents in this particular movie, this particular version?
Oh, he's clearly representing the sense of balance in nature, and that environmental theme played out against the questions of nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, and he's clearly trying to balance that force in the world, that humans have upset the balance, and Godzilla is going to reset the balance and bring it back to where it should be.
I could really see, if I were someone living in Japan, having gone through the tsunami and the nuclear meltdown at that power plant afterward, that would really say, that would speak to me.
Yeah, I think there were scenes in this that for Japanese who were traumatized by those events of 2011, I think they're very, very resonant scenes in the film. There is a nuclear plant that melts down as part of the plot. And it's clearly a response to those disasters that we've all lived through.
I keep referring to Godzilla as a he. Is it clear that Godzilla is a he?
It's not very clear what gender Godzilla actually is. Conveniently, in Japanese, in the Japanese language, we don't use gendered pronouns. So Godzilla is simply it. However, since the beginning of the history of Godzilla in the West, Godzilla has been referred to as male. In some of the films, he has a son. Never clear exactly where the son comes from. In some of the films, there are eggs involved. But it's never clear who lays them. So it's a little bit of an unusual situation that the original film doesn't give it give Godzilla a gender. But in English, we have to give him one. We really don't feel comfortable talking about it all the time. So by convention, Godzilla scholars refer to him as he, most of the time.
Okay. Let's go back to the telephone. We have Larry in Old City. Larry, welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, hi. How you doing?
Good.
Did you guys ever see the Saturday Night Live episode where Barbara Wawa interviews Godzilla?
Barbara Walters interviewing Godzilla. I don't think I have seen that. Have you seen that one?
Yes, it's a famous part of the history.
So, Larry, tell us about that skit. What do you remember from it?
It was when... what's her name, used to play Barbara Walters, and she called herself Barbara Wawa. She has a stage with a model of Manhattan sitting on the floor, and then Godzilla comes in, and she interviews him. How hard is it to act in the movie? It's just not hard at all. He gets up and kicks Manhattan to pieces, you know? But I think it was Belushi in the Godzilla outfit. It's riotous. I mean, it's very, very funny.
That must have been Jane Curtin playing Barbara Walters. Is that correct?
I think it was actually Gilda Radner and John Belushi. It's one of their interactions.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have to go look that up because that does sound like a riot. Thank you for calling, Larry. I want to talk just in the minute or so that we have left here a bit more about your class, Monsters of Japan. It's a seminar for freshmen at University of Pennsylvania, correct? And you don't talk about just Godzilla. You talk about other monsters, right?
We talk about the whole history of monsters in Japan. The very earliest Japanese history book has a monster story. There are many, many stories throughout Japanese history. We talk about Godzilla. We talk about pocket monsters, or as we know them, Pokemon. We talk about many, many different aspects of monsterhood in Japan, and also a lot about the way that was understood in the United States. If I can put in a little plug, we also do a film series on the campus, and those films are open to the public for free. They'll be on Wednesday nights beginning in September.
And so what this seminar for freshmen, Monsters of Japan, what do you hope your students sort of take away from it at the end?
There are two things I want my students to come out of it with. Number one, they're just freshmen. They've probably never heard of East Asian studies as a discipline and the fact that we can focus on just that part of the world. Number two, I want them to learn how to look at a film critically, not only as a plot, but also as a visual, as an audio event, and to learn to understand and analyze different aspects of cinema.
Godzilla just seems like a good subject to sort of help us understand the world better.
Well, he's got so many different iterations, 30 different films that we can look at, and that makes it a very useful tool to learn those things.
Frank Chance is Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He teaches the freshman seminar, Monsters of Japan. Thanks much for being here today.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find links to our Twitter handle, our Facebook feed, and there's information on podcasts. So the engineer today is Adam Staniszewski, and the producers of Radio Times are Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain.